bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, MP for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, from gold-backed dollar to petrodollar to narco-dollar, the decline, no, the criminalisation of the dollar. It isn't even discussed as London hosts the world's anti-corruption conference. And Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff, elected on an anti-corruption ticket. She is ousted by the corrupt old guard just before the Olympic Games. So will Brazil return to military dictatorship, or is the CIA and its US meddling in South America going to be more subtle this time? And NATO's political lobby, 4 weeks to the Bilderberg conference in Dresden and 6 weeks to the EU referendum. This week we find out Angela Merkel and her top six ministers will be there. And it's not a political meeting, just informal discussions, no press allowed and no questions asked. Pull the other one. And murder charges for British personnel involved in lethal drone strikes. That's the warning from a parliamentary committee this week, as well as new revelations about the extent to which our taxpayers' money is going to fund the Syrian rebels' PR operation. Yes, you and I paying for terrorist propaganda. You couldn't make it up. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, feeling fresher but plenty of sunshine this weekend. Next week, highs of 16 again, sunnier at the beginning of the week, cloudier with showers towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 21st and 22nd of May, highs of 16, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's the MP for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair. Hi, Thangam. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for welcoming me on the show.
And for the first time, too, since you were elected in May last year, and now you were sort of taken out of the loop almost as soon as you were elected, weren't you?
Yeah, but I did have a chance to get started, so at least I got my staff, some of my staff recruited, my office sorted out, and I was starting work. I'd made my maiden speech, and I'd got going, and I was able to carry on doing a lot of work from the constituency while I was having treatment for breast cancer.
Can you tell us a little bit about that treatment and how it affected you, what kind of treatment you were having?
Well, I found a lump a few weeks after I got elected. I then got diagnosed fairly quickly and started treatment on the 2nd of July. I had 6 rounds of chemotherapy, which is pretty punishing, but there are good weeks and bad weeks, so I was able to do quite a lot of constituency work in the good weeks.
After when you say a round of chemotherapy, is that like a week of it or a few days how does it work?
How it works is you sit there for an hour or so in hospital with a load of chemotherapy drugs going straight into your arm. It's a liquid, and then you go home. But the cycle is basically, well, for me, that cycle is one dose of it, 1 week of feeling absolutely awful and lots of nasty things happening to you, 1 week where you feel a little bit better and 1 week where you feel quite perky, and then by the end of the perky week you're back to zero again.
Oh no, so as soon as you're starting to feel back to your normal self, it's another round. Oh gosh.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, you get through it, and I'm very, very fortunate in many ways that nowadays breast cancer is extremely treatable and the survival rates are very good, very encouraging. Of course, there's always more to do, and we don't want anyone to be dying of breast cancer, we don't want anyone to be dying of cancer full stop. So I'm very pleased that even the time since I've had been diagnosed, there's been more research come out that's really helping medical people to target treatment.
So, I mean, have the hospital given you an explanation as to maybe how you caught this or how you got it and how to avoid getting it in the future?
Well, it isn't the genetic one. I haven't got the form of cancer, which is a genetic mutation, so I haven't got, you know, in my family. Well, cancer's caused by cells multiplying. And at the moment, what they're doing is trying to find out which genetic mutations cause that to happen and how. But all I'm interested in when I have cancer is how to get rid of it. And yes, they have given me advice that we all breast cancer women are offered in Bristol are offered a place on a course on how to help stay healthy after cancer. And, you know, every patient with cancer knows it's a tricky thing, because you don't want to spend the whole rest of your life worrying about it. But obviously it is at the back of your mind, and staying healthy is key.
Well, look, give us a few tips from the course, if you don't mind. What sort of thing, because none of us want it, do we?
No, I mean, you know, nobody wants cancer. And the sad fact is about one in two of us is going to sometimes experience having cancer in our lifetimes. And the things are kind of really the obvious ones. I'm afraid they are stay healthy, reduce your weight if you're overweight, try not to drink too much, don't smoke ever, and you know, those are the basic things. Of course, it's caused by cells multiplying, and that isn't necessarily, even if you stay healthy, there are lots of healthy people who get cancer, lots of unhealthy people who don't, so it isn't that straightforward, but it reduces your risk if you, you know, live a healthy lifestyle.
Fascinating. Anyway, I just hope you know, you stay clear and it's all sorted out, Thangam.
Well, having chemo, then an operation and a load of radiotherapy, that's kind of as good as it gets at the moment. And I'm, you know, I've been told at the moment that I'm doing pretty well.
Anyway, look, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. Thangam Debonair is not the ordinary name. What's your parents, your background?
Well, my mum, who just happens to be sitting over in the corner of the studio, behaving herself quietly. My dad came from Oxford, and she was a pianist and went to the Royal Academy of Music, where she met my dad, who was also a pianist. He'd come over from India on the boat to study at the Royal Academy of Music. So I came from a family of musicians, and I did indeed become a musician myself. I learnt to play the cello at a very young age. And for quite a long time, playing the cello professionally was all I really wanted to do. And I did indeed do it for quite a while, up until about 5 years ago, but it wasn't my main job. Most of the last 26 years I've spent doing work on domestic violence prevention. So I've worked with women, I've worked with men, I've worked with male victims, female victims, male perpetrators, with children. I've set up prevention programs in schools, and I've done research nationally and internationally, or been involved with it. So that's what I did for 26 years.
Well, domestic violence is really most of the time put across as something. Is it true that women attack men too in domestic situations?
That sometimes happens as well, and overwhelmingly the majority of chronic long-term offenders are men, but about a fifth of them are women.
And okay, so what can you do with people like that? Is it just about going in and separating people, or what?
That's not always realistic. I mean, people want the violence to stop, not the relationship to end.
Oh,
very often
it's
more complicated picture of dependency. But I worked mainly in the last 10 years with perpetrators, mostly male, occasionally female. And I did work on a perpetrator program where I was helping those men who were willing to try to change. But often it's a carrot and stick. You do need the criminal justice system to work as well. So part of my job was, you know, working with the criminal justice system and making sure that where people needed sanctions, they got them. But ultimately, even if someone goes to prison, they're going to come out eventually. I mean, criminal justice and the penal system, we need to have the focus on rehabilitation, whatever the crime was. And for domestic violence, there are ways in which you can help reduce harm and aim for a non-violent person. I wouldn't say they're all saints, but certainly some of the men I worked with stopped using violence and were no longer a danger.
What about your vision for the city? Because you've been elected last May. People haven't actually seen much of you because of all your treatment. So what is the Thangam vision?
Well, actually, I think people saw quite a lot of me because I was in the constituency more than most MPs. So, while other MPs were in Parliament, I was here. And I've seen an awful lot of people across the constituency. And my vision is everything that's great about Bristol being greater, because it's a wonderful city in so many ways, but it's a city of great inequality. So I represent the constituency Bristol West, which ought to be called Bristol Central, really, because I have the city centre in my constituency. Everything from Horfield Common down to Spike Island, from the Clifton Suspension Bridge to the Barton Hill Flats. So I, in my constituency, it kind of reflects the gaps between rich and poor, between people who feel like they've got a participation and a say in the city and those who don't. And in my vision is that the diversity becomes something that we celebrate and make good, that equality becomes meaningful, that people understand that the reason we should invest in every part of Bristol is because nobody knows where the next great entrepreneur or the cure, person who's going to cure cancer, or the person who can think of a way to make solar panels cheap. Nobody knows where that person's going to come from. I want to make sure that every child has a chance to fulfil their potential, and that every child's education is treated as special, and every child's potential can be released during their time in school and college, but also that every adult feels valued. And at the moment, I think that's there for a lot of people in the city, and it's not there for everyone.
Well, it's not, is it? No, and one of the problems is that the gap between rich and poor is getting wider and wider all the time. It's almost like becoming a bit of a chasm, a bit of an embarrassment that that there is this massive difference between a massive increase, in fact, of street homeless in the city.
Yes.
And one of the news stories this week, benefit sanctions handed out to thousands of people have been shown to be unlawful.
Yes.
This is John Stone writing. I'm not sure whether this is the Guardian or the Independent, but it says sanctions imposed on thousands of benefit claimants for not taking part in the Department for Work and Pensions so-called back-to-work schemes are unlawful, a court has ruled. Three Court of Appeal judges upheld an earlier decision by the High Court, potentially paving the way for millions in refunds to people who had their incomes cut whilst they were unemployed.
Yeah, and again, this is how I've been around my constituency, because I've seen a lot of constituents who've come to me for help, and my caseworkers and I have been dealing with many situations just like this. We have dealt with instances where the DWP has definitely not stuck to what it should be doing. Now, I don't want to discredit the entire institution, but we found instances where people haven't been given benefits they were entitled to, have been lopped off them when they weren't where they shouldn't have been, when we've rung them up and they've said, oh yes, okay, it's all sorted and the check's in the post, and then nothing arrives. And that's part of the work of a good constituency MP. A good constituency MP should be prioritising the needs of every constituent, but particularly I believe, as a Labour MP, my duty is to prioritise those people who have the least voice and the least ability to be able to take matters under control themselves.
So you're in a situation where you get a phone call from a constituent or a letter.
Yeah.
If they can afford the postage stamp, because often, of course, if you're being cut off from benefits, you've simply got no money for the basics. You're looking at possibly even being evicted from your home, this sort of thing. Can you actually make a difference?
Yes, although it's frustratingly slow and frustratingly difficult under a Tory government. I'll make no...
For all those out there who are saying this, it doesn't make any difference who you vote for, don't bother voting, they're all the same. I think there's a bit of a lesson in there, isn't there?
I think the lesson is also, I hope everyone can see now, we are living with a government who thinks austerity is a really good idea, who thinks that that's how you grow an economy. Well, it clearly isn't. Who doesn't value everybody in our society, who allows a situation to go on where they slash grants to local authorities, so local authorities, local councils are forced to dish out cuts because they've got less money coming in from central government. And this is a government that prioritises the rich over the poor. It's given the rich tax breaks in every single budget they've made, and what's done at the opposite end is it's made life harder for every single person who's on a low income or a low paid job or is out of work.
But you see, the thing is, there isn't enough money. That's the problem, is that there isn't enough money to go around.
Yeah, because
there isn't enough to pay these people. So this is why the Department of Work and Pensions is basically saying, well, look, anybody that puts a step wrong, we'll see if we can take their benefits away, because we haven't got enough for everyone.
And that's a choice that this government's made. It's chosen to give less money to the DWP. It's chosen a strategy, an economic strategy, which is patently failing. It's a strategy of austerity. Austerity cuts the economy off at the knees. It's working for the richest. It's not working for people on middle incomes. People on middle incomes haven't had a pay rise in years. People on low incomes have definitely had a pay cut. And this idea that there's a finite pot of money, economies grow. That's what economies should do when they have investment, when we invest in the roads, the transport, the infrastructure, the education, the healthcare system. We make a system that works for people. That's how you grow an economy. And at the moment, we've got people running the country who don't think that's a good idea. And that's why the DWP keeps handing out these awful decisions.
Well, one of the most embarrassing things, I think, for Britain these days is the increase in homelessness, Bristol particularly.
It's shocking.
I mean, you know, there's no humanity in the way that these people are being treated. But I noticed in this week in Inside Housing, there's a homelessness duty would cost councils £44 million. By Heather Spur in Inside Housing. Introducing a new homelessness prevention duty would initially cost British councils £44 million a year. In total, a report has found, a panel of housing experts organised by Crisis last month officially published its recommendations, calling on ministers to introduce new duties on councils to prevent people becoming homeless. Now, what they've been doing is looking at the Welsh Government, because they imposed a duty on councils to prevent homelessness within 56 days, and the government gave them £4.9 million, that's the Welsh Government, to do it. So this actually seems quite cheap, doesn't it?
Yes,
£44 million pounds to fix homelessness across the country. Isn't it a bit of a no-brainer?
I mean, it's a bit of a no-brainer for me, because I think, what on earth sort of country do we want to live in? Do we really want to live in a country where there are people living in tents and on the streets? We've had people come to us because they've been sleeping on shop doorways. I thought that had gone out after the Tory government was kicked out in 1997. I remember this from the 80s. It feels like the 80s coming back. We've had people homeless in tents outside my office, and when we've tried to help them, it's been really difficult because the council says they haven't got enough housing, which I know is true, and I feel for the housing officers, to be honest, but that's not the answer. What we've got instead is private rent skyrocketing, and even in the cheapest part of my constituency, the rents are so high that a young person starting out on a starter job on a minimum wage would never be able to afford to rent even just a one-bedroom flat, and even if they were shown, they'd struggle. Now, that's a choice. The government didn't choose to regulate rents or do anything about the private rented sector. It did nothing. The private rented sector must think that it's had a Christmas present every year. And at the moment, so that means that we're spending more on housing benefits.
Because the thing is, and the other thing is, as rents go up, and as house prices generally go up for people who are buying mortgages and that sort of thing, this shows up as an increase in growth in the economy. This is the thing that bothers me, is it starts, everything starts to look, oh, well, there's growth, we've got growth. This is a bit of a, I'm not sure, what do you make of that thing? I mean, it looks to me like that's actually kind of an illusion, that something's going on when it isn't.
It is, and it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable growth that's built on really, really generating a sustainable income, and where the income is fairly shared out, because I don't believe in growth for growth's sake. I believe in growth that's fairly shared out, where everybody gets a fair crack at it, and everyone gets a fair share at it. And I thought we learned from the last property crash that basing an economy and analysing economic growth and saying it's doing well just because house prices are going up is a bad idea. It was a bad idea last time, it's a bad idea this time.
Now, one of the reasons that some people have given, at least some of the commentators I've read, for Marvin Rees's victory in the mayoral election last weekend, I mean, it was over 3 days. Actually, before we say that, I don't know, why is it that Bristol is the last city in the country to announce its local council elections? I mean, we're supposed to be a high-tech city. I mean, surely they can... we had, first of all, didn't we? We had the mayor took a day
PCC
to announce...
First. No, it's the PCC.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Police and Crime Commissioner on the Friday.
Then
Marvin was announced on the Saturday. And then the City Council, which Labour got a majority on the Sunday. It seems a very long time.
It does seem a very long time. But here again, I think we've got to look at the effect of central government cuts to local government. So, yes, what the local council could have done was spent three times as much money to get everything done at once on a Friday, and it would have been really complicated. The voting papers were really complicated. Okay, it wouldn't have been three times as much, but it would have been more, because it would have been really tricky to untangle all those voting papers. Now, I am not the electoral returning officer, so I can't explain it. I would have liked them all to come out on Friday.
We're going to have to drag her in here. I've tried a couple of times.
It would be great to know, but I think there may be a good explanation, so I don't want to criticise, but I do think it felt like a really long, drawn out, either toothache or reshuffle to me. you wanted to ask me about Marvin.
Yes, go on.
Yeah.
What do you make of Marvin then?
Well, I think he's terrific, obviously, and I'm delighted that he's won. I mean, you know, don't say you would say that, wouldn't you? But I think he's fantastic. I think it's inspirational, actually, that we've got someone who believes in ending equality, who actually sets out a platform that says inequality is wrong. Deprivation is wrong. We shouldn't be living in a city where people are homeless or struggling or can't manage to put food on their kids' table. So I think it's fantastic that Marvin is championing getting rid of that sort of social evil, which is what it is. And I also think it's wonderful how much Marvin champions diversity in a really meaningful way. But most of all, Marvin's commitment to housing should help shift some of the things we've been talking about. And building more homes is just an absolute priority.
Yes, I know he's talked about that pretty much straight away. I think it's interesting the way that housing seems to have been in the forefront for a lot of people. And almost everybody, every level in the housing market has got a problem of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. Possibly apart from the people who've already bought their own homes, but people who are buying them on a mortgage can see that actually the prices are potentially going to go down. They may lose, you know, at some point in the future, go into negative equity. But the government seems to be, and you could maybe, as someone who is looking at this from a Westminster point of view, explain to us why it is that the government seems to be obsessing about trying to make sure that house prices are always just going up.
I don't know. You'd have to ask a Tory. Ask Charlotte Leslie. Because I don't get it. No, seriously, I don't get it. Because we've got a housing association sector which wants to build and is constantly frustrated by stupid ideas like the right to buy, which, you know, has now been negotiated somewhat. But that's a bad idea. And I don't know how they can do this.
And so, I mean, isn't it? I mean, for some people, it may be the way to just get the first step on the housing ladder, mightn't it? The right to buy?
Yeah, not if we can't replace the housing. You know, then the housing association stock goes down.
Just to look into the local elections, because I was pretty appalled with the BBC's coverage nationally, not locally, they're very good locally and regionally, but nationally, of Marvin's election as Bristol Mayor, for example, hardly covered at all in the national press, and talking to people in other parts of the country, many of them hadn't actually heard anything about it. The whole of the election was spun as, oh dear, this is a disaster for Jeremy Corbyn, and yet, just digging out the figures from the BBC, the Conservatives lost 47 council seats. That brings them up to 828, and Labour lost 18 council seats. That's to 1,289. So, actually, the Conservatives lost a lot more council seats than Labour did across the country. So, anyway, I suppose Bristol's kind of just in tune with the national trend in that Labour is now running the council. But what does that actually mean, Thangham? Now Labour has a majority on the City Council.
Well, I mean, we have a majority on the City Council, and we have a Labour Mayor, and we have three Labour MPs, and that's fantastic. What I think it means is that you've got people with Labour values running the city, and showing leadership with Labour values means making hard decisions, yes, because the Tories have made life very difficult for every local council, but where choices can be made, to choose the fair way of doing things, to choose the way which doesn't leave people out, which prioritises building homes and prioritises making them affordable for people to live in. And it's about Labour choices, and having a team that's united I think is really good for Bristol. I don't know if it's a national trend, but I would say it's brilliant that we've got a Bristol Labour Mayor and a London Labour Mayor. I think that's fantastic.
Well, I mean, just looking at the BBC website, if the Conservatives lost 47 and Labour only lost 18 council seats, I mean, it may be that that there were councils that got lost more Labour than Conservative, but if you're looking at the actual number of seats, then, you know, it doesn't look as bad as we were being spun by the BBC. Anyway, I should bring you in, Martin. You've been sitting there very patiently and quietly. What do you make of the sort of tectonic plates shifting here in Bristol last weekend?
Well, we were discussing earlier why the Tories pursue these absurd housing policies. I think under the current existing first-past-the-post electoral system, the swing constituencies which a Labour Party has to win in order to form a government at national level are quite a small number of constituencies, mostly in the southeast of England, and with swing voters, less than 500,000 swing voters in those constituencies decide the result. And what then tends to happen is that everybody, the cephologists, the PR people, the spin doctors, all concentrate their minds and their fire on that 500,000 people. And these people are the ones who are aspirational to get onto the housing ladder, and possibly can be helped onto the housing ladder by a handout from the government, which they don't accept is a handout. I mean, these are supposedly free marketeers, but they're willing to give handouts to get people onto the housing ladder. And it's basically a scam. And I don't think it's really going to change until the electoral system itself is changed, as it has been changed in Scotland and in Wales. And therefore, of course, a different dynamic has begun to develop in the politics in those two jurisdictions. I think ultimately the kind of rows or, you know, simmering row in the Labour Party about the direction of travel is bound up with this as well. When Jeremy Corbyn came to Bristol, I asked him a question at the meeting that was held. I asked him about what he felt about changing the electoral system, and he said that he was in favour of having a constitutional convention to look at all the issues, you know, House of Lords.
No, I mean, he's not going to change the electoral system, Martin, because actually the first past the post thing is quite good for Labour, and it keeps out the small parties.
Well, I would disagree. I know there's going to be a debate about this. I it's always been my view that the electoral system poisons the politics, because you end up chasing those swing voters in those marginal constituencies, and those people can be bribed and they can be bamboozled, and they are bribed
but, I mean,
and bamboozled
not,
by using the housing market.
He's not going to be a turkey voting for Christmas, is he?
Now, listen, in New Zealand, Tony, the left wing of the Labour Party and the trade unions forced a change in the electoral system in the early 1980s as part of their renovation of the society. I think we're going to have to come back to this.
Thangan, what do you make of this? Is it a bit of a non-starter, this idea of changing over to using a more proportional vote? I mean, actually, we used a different type of vote, didn't we, to elect the Police and Crime Commissioner and the mayor.
And the mayor. And I think it's really interesting that we are easing into different ways of voting. People now vote in a non first past the post system in European elections, in mayoral elections, and Police and Crime Commissioner elections. So we are learning to do it. And Martin's absolutely right. At the moment, the current system we've got places an enormous importance on a handful, and it is a handful in electoral terms, of southeast, southwest, and eastern England seats, and where at the moment Labour holds only 12 of those seats out of 100 and something. And we need, if we're going to win a general election, if we're going to win an overall majority, what with the cuts to the number of seats that there's going to be in the Boundary Commission review, if they're cut from 650 to 600, we're going to be in an even harder position. So whilst I agree with you, Tony, that there was a lot of really nasty spin, I also think it's not greatly new news that the mainstream media doesn't particularly love the Labour Party. That's never been, you know, it's always been like that. But also, in the cold hard maths, we may have made fewer losses than the Tories, but unfortunately in the constituencies where we need to make gains if we want to win in 2020, we aren't making enough gains yet. So of course it's good that we are making, you know, we're making progress, but it needs to be a hell of a lot quicker considering how much further back we're going to start next time when we lose 50 seats. Most of those are going to affect Labour Party.
Oh, that's right, yes, there's a whole load of changes going on to the boundaries, and we're having less MPs, so less reason to vote,
and
folks.
Can I add to that? Also, the new boundaries are going to be drawn upon the basis of the existing electoral registers, which we know to be corrupt. There are less people registered
to
vote now.
Martin, I was just reading today.
The last
one,
time, because they're making it more difficult for people to register.
I was just reading today, there's 1.25 million 18 to 24-year-olds who are not actually registered to vote.
Which is one of the reasons it's so great that Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, today has been canvassing and working with young people to try and get young people motivated to sign up to vote in the referendum.
Well, I mean, surely this is partly because it's quite a bureaucratic system now.
It's a nightmare.
The sinister thing is they're going to redraw the boundaries on the basis of these corrupt registers.
And
so in other words, it's not the boundaries could be drawn on the basis of population, and then the turnout wouldn't matter.
As far as I'm
concerned,
once you've drawn it on the basis of the electoral register, you're rigging the system. Yeah, they simply
It's very
can't.
Similar to what went on in Northern Ireland before 1969.
I mean, they're not interested in democracy if that's what they're doing. For young people particularly, they may have other things on their mind, first of all, but secondly, and more importantly, a lot of them move around a lot of things. So it's not easy to make sure you're registered.
Well, we lost a lot of young voters in the last round of registration, partly because forms got missed. Post comes through the letterbox, there's loads of junk mail, they move around a lot, they've moved, when they come, you know, they move on, they don't get the forms in time, it is a bureaucratic process, and we are losing young people because, again, I have to come back to it, the cuts to local government mean that the local government's got less to spend on ensuring that the electoral register is as good as it could be. Now, I know, Martin and I probably both know this, you can go and knock on lots and lots of doors and find loads of non-voters. Now, if I can knock on those doors, so too could Bristol City Council, I know they find it hard to do that.
We've also had revelations this week about the Electoral Commission actually investigating Thangam, the Conservative Party, over effectively over fraud to do with submissions of how much was spent in last May's general election.
Yep. Yes, well, I mean, the MPs who won, the Tory MPs concerned, are putting their hands up and saying, no, nothing to do with me, Gov, nothing to see here. But there is something to see here, and it's how election expenses are accounted for. There are really strict rules, and, you know, you can go to prison if you break them. It's important that they're stuck to. So I'm really hoping that that's going to be sorted out.
Well, let's hope so. Martin, some would say that the Conservatives are using all sorts of tactics in order to try and, sort of gerrymander in some ways. But, to be fair to them, if the police wanted to do something about this, they could have done it last May or June. Why have they waited for a whole year?
Well, they've extended their investigation period, I understand, because they normally have to do something within a year, but they've extended it because it sounds as if they're going to do something. Incidentally, of course, Linton Crosby was knighted on the same day as his protege Zach Goldsmith crashed and burned in the London mayor election, which was run on an absolutely disgustingly divisive racist platform imported from Linton's successes in Australia, and he got a knighthood from the Queen on the same day as his strategy crashed and burned. But let's hope that's the end of him.
But the people of London, Martin, they saw through it, didn't they? And I'm just delighted. You know, it's London's come home to Labour, but also London saw through that racism.
Linton Crosby tactic. Yeah. Sorry, Sir Linton Crosby tactic. Lord Linton Crosby tactic. Backfired.
Yeah, it completely backfired. I think he just didn't understand London.
You know, I can remember reading George Orwell when he resigned from the BBC World Service in the Second World War. He was working for the Indian Service, I think, and he said, the reason that I'm resigning is not because I'm unhappy with the management, it's because the propaganda doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I'm actually doing you a favour by stopping doing it. So this has been a real lesson, Martin, hasn't it? Particularly this anti-Semitism scandal in the last few weeks.
Well, that's another story, which we can perhaps go on to in a moment, if you like. But, of course, it was it was pretty silly of Cameron to turn up in the Commons and accuse Khan of associating with a conservative Muslim cleric who's potentially a supporter of ISIS, and it turns out that the conservative Muslim cleric is a conservative and doesn't support ISIS. And in fact, if Cameron had made that remark outside the House of Commons, he could be sued for libel.
But that
tends to suggest that this is a shambles.
Well, completely, isn't it? I mean, he said it in the House of Commons knowing he had parliamentary privilege.
Yes.
Which I thought was absolutely
outrageous. In other words, it's not just Zach Goldsmith's failure, it's also the Prime Minister's failure.
Yeah.
And even Zach Goldsmith's sister, Jemima Goldsmith, who married Imran Khan, she wasn't very happy with the tack they took.
Wouldn't you, that those two might have had a chat before?
Yeah, well, I think what the thing is, Linton Crosby took over. Because he supposedly won the election for them last year.
Yeah.
He's basically a very nasty man.
But I think it's a lesson to us all about not letting a spin doctor run your campaign.
Well, that's
right.
Because, they've got to be the servants, not the masters.
Exactly.
I think it's kind of discredited Zach as well, possibly for the future. But interesting that it's backfired so spectacularly. London has basically put two fingers up to that campaign.
Yeah.
And that we've now got the first Muslim mayor in Europe.
Yes, I know.
Much to the delight of Donald Trump.
It's fantastic. He's put Donald Trump in such a pickle, hasn't he? I love the way that we've effectively managed to get Donald Trump to try and backpedal a little bit, because what's he going to do?
Yeah, well, that's Britain punching above its weight, isn't it?
Brilliant. I just thought that was fantastic. Sadiq Khan manages to take Donald Trump out. Loads and loads of Republicans.
Well, I don't think he's taken Donald Trump out.
What? No, but he's taken him down a bit.
He's taken some of the wind out of his sails.
He's had to backtrack on that nasty thing he said, and I think that's fantastic.
Anyway, look, we're joined on the line now by Steve Norman. Steve, hi, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Jerry. How you doing?
Steve is down in Avonmouth, and he's... Yeah, if you could stick your headphones on, thank him. Steve is down in Avonmouth, and I understand, Steve, that you're trying to stop the sale of one of the council houses which has already been sold in an auction a few weeks ago. So how are you getting on?
Yeah, it's looking good, Tony. I mean, we're rolling up. That's it. The plan is to stop the sale. I mean, our previous man had this policy where he wanted to offload perfectly good housing to the private sector.
So what have you actually done? Have you actually occupied the house? What can you tell us about what you've been doing down in Avonmouth? Because I know this is just a single house, I think, is a terraced house in a street, which was owned by the council, that they decided to sell off. What kind of condition was it in?
Absolutely perfect condition. They spent about £8,000 bringing it out ready for sale. They went in there, put a new bathroom suite, new kitchen, they got decorators in the front room, bare magnolia paint. You could walk in this house tomorrow, a family of three or four, and make a home. It's outrageous. And interestingly, you raised the point that he claimed it was unaffordable to maintain. I actually knew the previous tenant who was in there, and what had happened was there was a problem with the back room, with the flooring collapse. They moved her out temporarily, and when they had done the flooring, they asked the girl to return, but they put her in a different street in Avonmouth, and she said, well, no, I don't want that route again. So he was not truthful. Mayor Ferguson was not being truthful by any shape, standards, or whatever.
Steve, you're in a bit of a fix, aren't you? Because this house has actually been sold at auction. I mean, how on earth can you hang on to it? You can't stay there.
Well, they have to complete the sale. And I believe, thanks to Mr. Hooper, emailed him, and he was kind enough to give me the completion date, which is the 18th of May.
What about, because, I mean, you know, you're likely to be evicted from there, surely, and but people be moved out and the new owner it handed over by the City Council?
Well, it's down to the City Council to decide what they want to do. I mean, we were under threat of eviction, and that's not materialised as yet, although we were being told we were going to be evicted last night. Fortunately, it appears that public media and pressure, they went out on Twitter and other places, change that situation.
Well, it might also be another thing, mightn't it? It might also be that we've got a change of mayor. At the end of the day, this is down to the mayor. I mean, obviously, George Ferguson and or Marvin Rees will have been getting legal advice from somebody like the head of legal services, and also they would have been talking to the police, and that may be, you will be able to stay there. But anyway, what's your thoughts about what's going to happen next week, Steve?
Well, I'm hoping that, as I say, the sale doesn't complete, the house comes back into social housing stock. It's only one of 15. I would like to have saved 15. But interestingly enough, you know, there are other properties that are vacant. And I've since found out that Mayor Ferguson had a policy where if a person died in a home, it was not relet. And I actually know of two properties in Avonmouth that have been empty for a year. I've seen them. And that supports what I was told about Mayor Ferguson's policy if somebody died in these properties, because they're both alongside each other and around, and there were elderly people in them, and they passed away, and they've been empty for a year.
Well, anyway, it's good that somebody's on the case down there anyway, keeping an eye on council property. Thanks very much, Steve. And how do people follow what you're doing? Is this on online or I'm Twitter. Thinking about social media, things like that?
Yeah, social media, Twitter, Facebook, you know, we're keeping up. And as I say, on a final note, I'm hoping that Marvin will... I'm hoping we can find some compromise here and save this house.
Okay, that's Steve Norman there down in Avonmouth. Thanks very much for joining us, Steve. But Thangan, what do you make of this? Because it's not easy, is it, to change this policy around? It's almost like an oil tanker going in one direction. Suddenly Marvin's in the hot seat. Sounds to me as if this week he's had some pretty harsh decisions to make straight away.
But Marvin is his own man. He's a good man. He's a strong man. He's really, really capable of making difficult decisions. He's been preparing for this for some time, and he'll be taking good advice. And I know that Marvin will be making the right decisions in difficult situations. Of course, it's going to be really hard for him. You know, being a mayor under a Tory government is no joke. And he's going to have to make some really difficult decisions. But I really hope that he can start turning the housing tank around as soon as possible. There are a lot of housing association providers who really want to help him do that.
Martin, also, of course, we're in a situation down there in Avonmouth where you've got council... I mean, this is a big decision for Marvin, isn't it, this week? Because a house has been sold at auction. It's then been apparently taken over by some of the locals saying, no, we don't want this house to go. And it's very difficult for the person that bought it at that auction and awkward for the council to manage that whole process.
Well, it depends who's actually bought it, doesn't it? It might have been bought by a developer.
No, it hasn't. It's been bought by
a family.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it could be that, as the fellow was saying, it won't be completed. You don't have to complete. It's not been completed yet. So it's not actually been sold until it's been sold. I think it's a very difficult decision.
I mean, if Marvin does decide to keep this house ownership, it sends a very strong message that he's determined to stop the sell-off and start the building programme, possibly.
Well, it would be a good, strong message to send, but really that's his call. Because, of course, if you're going to do that, you've then got to, you know, disappoint the people who've bought the house, etc. I wouldn't like to say that everything depends upon whether Marvin agrees or not, but I think it's great that people in Avonmouth have got the gumption to force the issue in this way and put the awkward ball in Marvin's direction.
Marvin is a mayor, but he's not going to be the only mayor possibly soon. There may be something called a metro mayor. This apparently, Thangam, is a form of devolution. And we've heard this week from Bath and North East Somerset councillors who are part of this metro mayor area. They have said yes to the £1 billion from the government, but no to the metro mayor. What should we be saying? And who is this metro mayor?
Well, it's part of the deal. And it's kind of one of those things where you think, oh, this this looks good until you read the small print, which is, yes, we could get all this wonderful devolution, which I do think is a good idea, handing down more decision-making and more money to local areas on transport and planning and housing. That's a good idea. Getting the sort of local economic partnership, the LEP powers, rationalised along with housing and so on, is a good idea across the region.
Okay,
but
LEP. Every time I hear LEP, I hear local enterprise partnership. Now, this is pretty much unaccountable, but spends tens of millions of pounds of our money.
And I completely agree. I think that's one of the problems with the LEP, is lack of democratic accountability. Now, reforming it is, I think, a priority. I think we really need to, because it's not always got the it's not been accountable to elected representatives, it's not been accountable to the people. It does quite a bit of good work, but there are some gaps there that really need fixing.
Well, they seem to spend money on themselves sometimes.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do think that the
devolution... Well, I'm talking about Western College spent quite a lot of money on themselves.
I don't know anything about that.
So I know it's out of your area, but if you look at where the money has been going, some of it has been going to the people sitting around the table.
That may be so, but that's one of the reasons why the government, I think, is saying to us, do you want this devolution deal? And what the government's offering is the accountability via one single metro mayor across the whole of the four council areas. Now, I don't think that's such a great deal, because I know that local councillors, they could provide the accountability. I think that's what they're there for. They're more connected and rooted in their communities. One single metro mayor over this whole area, I don't think is a great idea. I think the Labour council, the council here in Bristol City Council, would like people to be involved in that decision, just as we were in whether or not to have a local mayor, a Bristol mayor. I think that's a good idea, but personally, I just think we need the devolution. We don't actually need a metro mayor. That's my personal view.
Martin.
Yeah, I think I'll go along with that. I think the politics of a metro mayor down here are rather different than on Merseyside, where I was brought up.
Well, the logic is, supposedly, that this is actually a big conurbation, Bath and Bristol.
It makes sense, and there was, in fact, of course, Avon, local authority, before you know, it fell apart, the counties that used to be Avon, Cuba. The problem is that the politics down here are much more polarised. You've got the Tories running the sticks, you've got Labour running the Bristol City Council. Now, if you're going to have a metro mayor... It's either going to be a Tory, which will basically mean that Labour voters in Bristol are going to find that they're being told what to do by a Tory standing above Marvin, or we win, and then the Conservative voters in the sticks are going to be told what to do by radical Mayor Marvin.
Well,
you know, either way, they're not going to be happy.
You've convinced
be happy.
Me there as to why this might not work.
It's a bad idea. I'll tell you what else it means, Tony. It means another election next year. I mean, Bristol this year, we've had all-out elections, we've had the mayoral election, we've had the Police and Crime Commissioner election. I think that's enough. The idea was to have a break from elections. And seriously, it's not just because of the shoe leather for political activists, it's also because you need stability. You need to allow a council and a mayor some time to get on with things without constantly thinking about, oh gosh, I've got an election next year. And the metro mayor politicises everything if you have to have yet another layer of bureaucracy. I think it's a bad idea.
Now, one of the things that you're talking about elections, perfect cue to talk about Brexit vote or the EU referendum vote.
Ooh, let's
before I hear before before we hear your views on that thing, and Martin, we know yours because we had a big row about it last week. So let's have a listen now to a bit of an exchange about this week on Wednesday at the last Prime Minister's Questions of this parliamentary session, and here is the Leader of the Opposition, Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, asking David Cameron all about it.
He might be aware that Patrick Minford, a former economic advisor to Margaret Thatcher, has said that the European Union has a negative effect on the City of London, and he would want the shackles of European regulation removed. Does the Prime Minister believe that membership hurts the City of London, or does he believe that European Union regulation of the finance sector in Britain and British administered tax havens would help the sort of bad practice exposed by the Panama Papers or underlined by my friend in his earlier question today?
Well, this is an area where we basically agree with each other about the European Union, so I'll try and identify a question in that lot and answer it as positively as I can. First of all, on Patrick Minford, I completely disagree with the economist Patrick Minford. He wants to see manufacturing industry in our country obliterated, and I think would be a disastrous step if we followed the advice that he gives. In terms of the City of London, we need the right regulation for the City of London to continue its massive rate of job creation and wealth creation in our country, but we also need to remain members of the single market, because it's absolutely vital for this important sector of our economy. And I hope on that, as on the issue of the national living wage, we can find some agreement between each other.
Oh, well, sir, some conciliatory tones. Thangham, what do you make of the... And we've also had the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, this week coming out and saying he's not really allowed to, but he's made sure that everyone knows what he thinks about whether we're going to stay in or out of the European Union.
Well, I'm in favour of staying in the European Union. I'm very happy to say that. I believe Boris Johnson's on his way to Bristol even as we speak to tell us that it's bad for us and it's costing us loads of money. And what he's leaving out is what we get for that money. We make a contribution so that we can be part of a family, a free trading partnership between a large number of nations. We in Britain need to trade with the European Union. It's where the jobs come from. It's very simple for me. It's where the jobs come from. Now, democratic accountability, I do agree, could be improved. But so too with Parliament, so too with Council, so too with other institutions. Abolishing them doesn't improve them, and removing ourselves from them also doesn't improve them. If we remove ourselves from the European Union, we won't be part of reforming it, and we won't be part of the free trade area that massively boosts our trade. But we stand to lose from this.
Where do you stand on the whole migrant and immigration thing? Because there is there are two sides to this.
Yeah.
Some people will say, oh, well, it's racist to say that people shouldn't be allowed to come and go as they please in Europe. And, of course, we've got a lot of migrants into Europe as well, so that complicates things. And also, there are also many people that say that over the last 10-15 years, actually probably maybe more 10 than 15, that the increased fluidity of labour within Europe has actually been an assault on wages and pay and conditions here in Britain.
When wages go down, if wages go down below the minimum wage, that's illegal, and employers need to be sorted out and cracked down on and prosecuted. And in actual fact, the World Bank published some evidence which I analysed last week, which actually said it has the opposite effect. Migration overall, globally, increases wages, or at worst, doesn't depress them.
But you've got also zero-hour contracts, haven't you?
Yeah,
where often people, they may be being paid the minimum wage, but they're not getting paid enough
Absolutely.
To pay the bills.
Yeah, but I don't think we can blame all that on the European Union. That's what a lot of British employers are doing, and at the moment we've got a government that doesn't really care about it. The Labour Party was going to make that impossible, except in really tiny, minute circumstances, but the country elected a Tory government last year, and that's what we've got. Whereas in the European Union, what we've got is a structure by which our workers' rights can be protected, even when we've got Tories. Now, I think the Tories would really, left to their own devices, if we really want to come out of the European Union and let Tories be in charge of maternity leave and paternity leave, and right to sick leave and paid holiday. Good luck with that, is what I say. I think it's great that we've got those enshrined in European law as well as British law. So no matter what the national government, our workers' rights do actually have to be protected.
Why are we seeing so much of this debate and discussion being made by Conservatives? It seems like it's sort of Boris versus Dave, this whole issue of whether we're going to stay in or out, and which worries me.
It worries me too.
Because it's a bit like the US elections a decade or so ago, when you had John Kerry and George W. Bush both standing from this Skull and Bones Society in America. Well, Boris, I'm not saying it's the same as the Skull and Bones, but Boris and Dave are both from the Oxford Bullingdon Club, aren't they? Both from the same little club when they were at college, and now they're both leading, supposedly, the debate as to whether we're going to stay in
or
out of Europe.
Yeah, doesn't that say everything that we don't want, that we need to know about the Tory government, is that it's been run by old Etonians from the Bullingdon Club. No, we need to make a strong Labour argument. We have actually been doing that. Alan Johnson launched Labour In for Britain weeks ago in Bristol at Airbus, a absolutely classic example of why we need to stay in the EU. Airbus is a multi-EU country company. It has apprenticeships and routes to degrees for young people in my constituency, and it's able to do that. That free movement of labour works both ways. Apprentices in my constituency can go and work in their units in France and in Germany easily without any visas, any problems, because of the free movement of labour. People move from here to Europe.
If you talk to people working up at Filton, a lot of them say, well, this place is being run down, whether or not we're in or out of
Europe. Well, Airbus has run down now.
Yes, because they've closed the runway. There's a whole load of that. Basically, the whole thing has been just turned over to housing development. And certainly, I mean, some of the people I spoke to from GKN are saying, actually, slowly but surely, this place is being run down. Well, Rolls-Royce seems to be maybe the only, maybe in a few years, the only people left. The other point I'd make there is, having a look at the Airbus, this is something that I was absolutely shocked to see.
Uh-huh.
The Airbus annual report about 3 years ago, they showed all of the plants in Europe where these planes are made. Filton was left off the list. It wasn't even on the map.
Well, I think they'll definitely be off the map forever if we come out of the European Union. I mean, that will be that. Airbus haven't actually said they will leave,
but
why would they stay?
Hasn't this
why
single market stay? Been part of why much industry has disappeared from Filton and other places around the country, places that used to provide tens of thousands of jobs, to other parts of Europe because it's cheaper labour elsewhere?
It works both ways. And one of the things we need to be doing is investing in skilled labour, because companies don't just go where labour is cheap. Good companies go where labour is good, where we have workforces that are trained and skilled and motivated. And that's one of the things this government is missing, because it doesn't have a productivity strategy. It doesn't have anything focusing on how we can equip workers for the next generation of jobs. It's got nothing to offer. And worse still, if we leave the EU, we won't even have the free movement of labour that works for our workers as well. We'll be stuck out on a limb without any ability to trade.
Well, a lot of people would say we will be able to trade.
We'll be able to trade, but there'll be trade barriers.
Can we move on to the next story? It's a call for blacklisting construction company bosses to be jailed. This is in the Mirror yesterday. Blacklisting victims say getting compensation is not the same as getting justice.
No.
The wretched companies that ran an illegal blacklist of construction workers finally apologised in court this week, having agreed to pay £50 million in compensation. But that's for 3,213 people. It's not a lot for each person who's possibly lost their entire livelihood from this.
No, but I mean, blacklisting is absolutely outrageous.
And it's criminal, surely.
It is, and it shouldn't be allowed, and it isn't allowed, and there should be better prosecutions. But also, I really feel for these people because they haven't got justice. You know, when you're denied the ability to work, that's one of the most basic things that most of us hope that we will be able to take for granted if we are skilled.
You know what, I'm reminded of Hillsborough here, because the Hillsborough victims, the families, have had the finger of blame pointed at the police and the officials who were in charge that day, but none of those people have actually been prosecuted and none of them have been jailed. So in a way, it's the truth is there, but as with blacklisting, but not justice. Martin.
Exactly. Truth without justice, I think, is a bit cheap.
Well, the same thing is true about the financial services sector, of course.
Yeah. Yes.
When people pay fines for rigging LIBOR or whatever, it's the company that pays the fines. Mm. So in actual fact, that's nobody's money in particular.
Yeah. It
belongs
suffering.
To the shareholders.
You know,
it's just a cost of doing business. If you actually spoke off the record with the people running these construction companies and say, are they happy at spending 50 million quid at the same time as keeping all these people out of work? They'd say it's cheap at the price from their point of view.
This leads
so it's no deterrent.
It's one of those
they
weird,
need to face jail time.
It's one of those weird moments, because it must be Friday the 13th, mustn't it? But it's one of those weird moments, because what Martin said there leads perfectly onto our next story, which is the BBC, because, of course, the chair of the BBC, Rona Fairhead, she's one of those people who was involved in the risk committee of HSBC, which was then prosecuted in the United States and had to pay fines of hundreds of millions of dollars for money laundering. And yet she's still the chairman of the BBC. This week we had an announcement that she's going to keep her job until 2019. Imagine we won't be seeing too many panoramas about money laundering while she's running the show. And they're also making quite a lot of changes, trying to increase the number of appointments to the BBC's editorial board, Thangam, that are made by the government, by the Prime Minister personally.
Yeah, well, that's why my boss, Maria Eagle, in the Shadow DCMS team, Shadow Department of Culture, Media and Sport, the day before the white paper came out on Wednesday, asked for and was granted by the Speaker an urgent question to put exactly that to John Whittingdale, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. And she asked him really, really clearly to justify, you know, why can he have a plan that allows him basically to nominate people to go on the board? It's just wrong.
It starts to look a little bit like a kind of what we were certainly brought up to think that the Soviet Russia was, where you've got the government directly appointing who is going to be running the state broadcaster. That is to say, you're getting the official news. It starts, Martin, to sound a little bit like the Ministry of Truth. The BBC is heading off in that direction.
Well, I was interviewed by Rush Today about this on Wednesday, actually. And, of course, they are funded directly by the Russian government. Now, in principle, in other countries, they have state broadcasters which don't have the same kind of structure as our BBC. But the BBC has its reputation because it doesn't have that kind of structure, that although it is funded indirectly through general taxation and the licence fee, the government of the day doesn't directly control its editorial policy. Now, having said that, of course, there is a lot of indirect pressure on the BBC, especially in international affairs.
Can I just point to the sacking of Greg Dyke back in 2003, the sacking of Alistair Milne by Margaret Thatcher in 1987, where you get specific government intervention to change who's going to run it. What's the best way to do it then, Thangam, do you think?
Governments shouldn't make appointments like that. I mean, it's never been good when governments get involved in making cultural appointments and deciding editorial policy. It's never been a good idea.
Well, we've had a situation where people from the city, that's Rona Fairhead, the latest chair, also Chris Patten, former Conservative, I think he was actually chair of the Tory party at one time. So the Conservatives have been doing it. Why haven't Labour started to, you know, over the years, I mean, you're not responsible for the Gordon Brown government, but why haven't Labour actually started to try and put their people who are more sympathetic to them in positions in the BBC in the past?
Well, I can't speak for the past, but what I can say, as I said, is Maria Eagle is absolutely on this and is pounding John Whittingdale on it, and we'll be having him back in front of the House of Commons as soon as possible to try and make him explain himself. He still didn't have an answer on Wednesday.
Will the licence fee be going up? Well, yes, it will. It will rise with inflation every year. By 2021 and 22, it's likely to have risen from £145.50 to £160, the equivalent of 44 pence a day. Well, not that bad value for money. And also, if you just want to listen to the radio, you don't have to pay anything. So the Conservatives withheld key documents from the election fraud investigation. I'm not sure we've quite got time, but I think we'll just finish off, because I think this is actually probably the most important story of the week, Martin, about electoral fraud. I get the sense here this is a little bit like the Murdoch scandal, the phone hacking scandal, when that first broke and Rupert Murdoch refused to talk about it, didn't want to talk about it. This may run, mightn't it?
It may, and if the Tory party falls apart over Brexit, we could have an election by the autumn.
Interesting thoughts. Thangam, the whole idea of the Electoral Commission investigating a political party for fraud at election, apparently that's totally unprecedented. It's not really happened before in Britain.
Yep, and that's why I agree with you. I think this one could run and run, and it could run in a very nasty way for the Tory party. I think they've got real questions to answer. They sent central Tory party machine to go and campaign in local campaigns explicitly for candidates without declaring it. Now, there are rules about this. I knew the rules. My agent knew the rules. It was my first time standing for Parliament. I don't really get why they've said that they don't know what's going on and it's nothing to do with them.
Well, it's also the Devon and Cornwall, I think, it is police... and Crime Commissioner, she really? Has been involved in this, so she's being investigated, not by that force, I might add. Anyway, that's all for now. We'll be back after the news. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that was MP for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair. We'll
Thank you for having me on.
After the news.
BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.